Usually, when you think about hacking into some kind of highly secured system, you imagine needing the exact right code, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like a very specific sequence of commands just to get past the firewall.
Exactly. I mean, you wouldn't expect to hack into the Pentagon using a state-of-the-art supercomputer and also a modified clunky garage door opener.
Right, because on paper, I mean, that shouldn't work at all. You don't use a crowbar to bypass facial recognition.
You really don't. But when we look at the human brain and specifically how we alter its default programming, we see exactly that kind of biological plot twist.
It's wild.
It is. So welcome to this deep dive. Today, we are looking at this massive comparative analysis from the OOTW Journal, and it focuses on two of humanity's absolute oldest psychedelics, mescaline and psilocybin.
Two very different, very iconic compounds.
Truly. And our mission for this deep dive, for you listening at home, is to cut through decades of cultural folklore. We want to understand how two entirely different molecules manage to hack the exact same neural network.
Right, and yet they find themselves on, well, wildly divergent paths in modern medicine and society.
Exactly. Okay, let's unpack this. Because for those of us who aren't organic chemists, to understand the end experience, we first have to look at the starting materials, right?
We do. We are looking at a sheer structural mystery here. And as your hacker metaphor suggests, on a molecular level, these two shouldn't behave alike at all.
Not even a little bit.
No. So let's take mescaline. It's drawn from these very slow-growing desert cacti, and chemically, it is a phenethylamine.
Right, a phenethylamine. And what does that actually mean in the context of the human brain?
It basically means it belongs to this very specific broad family of chemicals that are all based on a two-carbon chain.
Okay.
So mescaline is actually built on the exact same chemical backbone as the neurotransmitter dopamine, which, naturally regulates your reward pathways.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it's also in the exact same structural family as the empathogen MDMA. Plus, synthetic compounds like 2CB, it is essentially the ancient archetype of that entire chemical class.
That's crazy. And then psilocybin just flips that script entirely, doesn't it?
Completely flips it.
Because it comes from a mushroom, not a cactus, and it's a tryptamine, which means its structure is incredibly close to serotonin itself. But the real kicker here, and I love this part, is that the mushroom doesn't actually give you the active ingredient.
No, it doesn't. It gives you what we call a prodrug.
Right.
So when you ingest psilocybin, that specific molecule is essentially inert in your brain. It doesn't do anything on its own. Yeah, your body has to do all this biological labor to strip away a phosphate group from the molecule. It's a process called dephosphorylation.
So you have to unwrap it.
Exactly. Only once your digestive system and your liver unwrap that molecular package does it actually convert into the active molecule, which is psilocin.
Okay, so just to recap this for you listening, a cactus gives you a phenethylamine, fully assembled, ready to go. A mushroom gives you a tryptamine package that your body has to physically, chemically unwrap.
Yep, completely different shapes.
Different shapes, different natural sources, entirely different chemical families, and yet somehow they both end up converging on the exact same target in the human brain.
They do, because they are both classic serotonergic psychedelics,
Right.
which means their signature effects run almost entirely through agonism. That just means activation. And they activate the 5-HT2A serotonin receptor.
The famous 5-HT2A.
The very one. So to picture this, imagine the cortex of your brain. Deep within it, you have these things called layer 5 pyramidal neurons.
Okay, layer five.
Right? These are the heavy lifters. They're the primary output neurons sending signals all across the brain. And these 5-HT2A receptors are just densely packed all over those specific neurons.
So when either of these distinct molecules hits that receptor, it triggers this huge cascade, right? And neural entropy just rises.
Sure.
The brain's activity becomes less predictable, it gets less rigid, much more diverse, and the default mode network starts to loosen its grip.
Yes, the DMN, which is the network heavily tied to your rigid sense of self, your ego, all your self-referential thought. It just quiets down. What's fascinating here is that this convergence proves a massive point in modern pharmacology.
Which is what exactly?
That for classic psychedelics, the receptor matters far, far more than the actual chemical scaffold that triggers it.
Right. It's like using a physical jagged metal key versus a sleek digital key card. I mean, they look nothing alike. They operate on totally different physical principles,
Yep.
but they both somehow turn the tumblers and open the exact same safe in the brain. The lock just doesn't seem to care what the key looks like.
That's a great way to put it.
But wait, I have to push back on this for a second.
Sure.
If mescaline is structurally in the exact same family as MDMA, like you said earlier, why doesn't it just act like MDMA?
Ah, that's a good question.
Because why doesn't it just flood the brain with serotonin and act as a pure empathogen?
Right. So that comes down to the difference between being a direct receptor agonist versus being a releaser.
Okay, a releaser.
Yeah. So MDMA is essentially a chemical crowbar. It physically enters the neuron and forces it to just dump its own stored reserves of serotonin out into the synapse. It releases what you already have in the bank.
Got it.
Mescaline doesn't do that. Even though it shares that structural backbone with MDMA, mescaline operates by binding directly to the 5-HT2A receptor. It mimics serotonin.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it turns the lock itself, exactly like Slacen does, rather than forcing a flood of your natural neurotransmitter.
Okay, that makes sense. So they are both direct keys to that 5-HT2A safe. But if these two completely distinct molecules open the same safe, does the experience actually feel the same to the person inside?
Well, if you listen to the cultural folklore, absolutely not. They are completely different animals.
Right. The folk wisdom has very distinct personalities for these two.
Very distinct. Mescaline is traditionally described as this warmer, more embodied, highly grounded journey.
Lots of open-eyed visuals, right?
Exactly. Open-eyed, rooted in the desert, deep connection to the physical environment.
And then psilocybin is widely characterized as highly inward. You close your eyes, you lay down, you leave your body. It's heavily prone to that mystical dissolution of the self.
That is the narrative that has survived for literally decades in the counterculture.
And here's where it gets really interesting. In 2023, the science finally decided to put that mythological divide to the test, didn't it?
It did. A research group in Basel, Switzerland, conducted this absolute landmark trial.
Mm-hmm.
And we really have to emphasize how rare this is.
Yeah, it's unheard of.
It is the only double-blind, placebo-controlled, head-to-head study ever done comparing these two substances in humans, ever.
Wow. And they used 32 healthy volunteers.
Yes. And they used a crossover design, which is key.
Meaning the same person takes both.
Exactly. The exact same person took psilocybin on one day, and then weeks later, that same person took mescaline, and then on a third day, a placebo.
Right. So that eliminates the variable of individual brain chemistry. You are literally testing both keys in the exact same lock.
Precisely. And the results completely disrupt that centuries-old folklore.
It's wild, because when the researchers matched the drugs at psychoactive equivalent doses, they found no evidence of qualitative differences in the altered states of consciousness. None.
Zero. Across all their complex psychometric scales, the acute subjective effects, like the actual feeling of the peak trip, they were practically indistinguishable.
So imagine you're reading this 2023 clinical study. You'd probably think the folklore was just entirely fabricated.
You would.
But is there a massive blind spot here, like in how a tightly controlled clinical study actually measures an altered state?
Well, the clinical trial isn't wrong, but it is taking place in a sterile vacuum.
Right.
The Basel study proves that the acute psychological peaks match perfectly when you control every single external variable in a white-walled lab. But human beings don't experience life in a vacuum.
Obviously not.
A real-world psychedelic experience isn't just a 90-minute psychological peak. It is profoundly shaped by the bodily sensations leading up to that peak.
Mm-hmm.
And crucially, it is heavily dictated by the sheer length of the drug's effect.
Which brings us perfectly to the real differences between the two. Because if the peak feels the same, why not just treat them identically?
Because of what happens after that peak and the staggering differences in the physics of the dosage.
Let's talk about potency. Because to get that identical psychological peak, you are essentially comparing a pinch of salt to a cup of flour.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Psilocybin is roughly 10 to 20 times more potent by weight than mescaline.
10 to 20 times?
Yeah. A typical active dose of psilocybin used in these clinical trials is around 15 to 30 milligrams.
So it just fits into a tiny little capsule.
Exactly. Mescaline, however, has an incredibly moderate affinity for that 5-HT2A receptor. It just doesn't bind as aggressively.
Okay, so you need more of it.
A lot more of it. You need a massive payload of raw material to achieve the same neural entropy. A full dose of mescaline is between 200 and 400 milligrams.
Oh, so you are literally taking handfuls of powder.
You are. And your body has to process that massive payload, which completely alters the timeline and the metabolism of the whole experience.
Right. Because psilocybin comes on fast, right?
Yeah.
Like 20 to 40 minutes.
Yeah, very quick.
And the whole experience lasts roughly 4 to 6 hours because, going back to what you said earlier, it's a prodrug.
Exactly.
So once the liver converts it into psilocin, it does its job and then it's just rapidly broken down and cleared from the body.
Okay.
You can literally take it after breakfast and be completely sober by dinner.
But mescaline is a marathon. It has this very slow, creeping onset of 1 to 2 hours. And the experience lasts an exhausting 10 to 12 hours.
12 hours.
Yeah. The mean duration in that Basel study was roughly 11 hours. And it clears the body entirely differently, too.
How so?
Well, instead of being rapidly broken down by liver enzymes, that massive 400 milligram payload of mescaline is predominantly eliminated by the kidneys. It basically passes through your system largely unchanged.
Unchanged? Wow, I think of it like transportation, right?
Yeah.
Psilocybin is like taking a high-speed electric commuter rail. It's fast, it's highly efficient, you don't need a lot of luggage, and the infrastructure is designed to just get you in and out quickly.
Right.
But mescaline is like taking a cross-country freight train. You need a massive amount of heavy fuel, all those milligrams, just to get the engine moving. The biological processing takes all day and all night. And because you're hauling so much cargo, it is going to be a much bumpier ride for the tracks.
And that bumpy ride is the physical tolerability.
Right.
Now, to be clear, both of these substances actually boast very low organ toxicity. They won't damage your brain, they won't damage your liver, and neither carries a risk of classic physical dependence.
You cannot get chemically addicted to them.
You cannot. However, they do share the same severe contraindications. Anyone with a personal or family history of psychosis or bipolar disorder should absolutely avoid both.
Because they can precipitate manic or psychotic episodes?
Exactly. But physically speaking, your body reacts to the sheer volume of mescaline with a heavy physical lift.
The sympathomimetic load.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. Mescaline activates the sympathetic nervous system. That's your body's basic fight or flight response.
Right.
So when you ingest 400 milligrams of a phenethylamine, your heart rate rises, your blood pressure elevates. And because the human gut is absolutely packed with serotonin receptors, this massive dose triggers a highly reliable, famous early nausea and vomiting.
Ugh, right, the purge.
Yes. Your digestive system essentially hits the abort button before you ever reach that comparable psychological peak. It demands a physical toll that psilocybin just doesn't.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, that 11-hour duration and that intense physical toll, they severely complicate mescaline's viability in a modern therapeutic setting, don't they?
Completely.
Just think about the basic logistics of clinical psychiatry. A psilocybin session fits neatly into a standard clinic workday. The patient arrives at 9 a.m., undergoes the five-hour experience, integrates with the therapist, and is driven home by 4 p.m.
But an 11-hour mescaline session, that is an administrative nightmare for a clinic.
I can imagine.
It requires two separate shifts of therapists just to sit with the patient to avoid fatigue. It requires massive overtime pay. It occupies a clinical room for an entire day and late into the evening. I mean, the insurance billing alone makes it prohibitive.
And because of the sheer logistical physics, because it is a cross-country freight train, mescaline has basically completely lost the clinical race to psilocybin.
It has. And the result is a massive asymmetry in the scientific data we have today. The clinical scoreboard is entirely lopsided.
It's not even close.
Not at all. Psilocybin is undeniably the most clinically advanced classic psychedelic in human history right now.
Let's talk about Compass Pathways, for example.
Yeah, great example. Yeah. So Compass Pathways has developed this synthetic 25 milligram psilocybin formulation called COMP360.
Right.
And they recently published positive phase 3 clinical trial results specifically targeting treatment-resistant depression, or TRD.
And the numbers on that are just staggering. For you listening, they reported a negative 3.6 placebo-adjusted MADRS drop at week 6. Now, if you aren't a psychiatrist, ADRS is the Montgomery-Åsberg Depression Rating Scale.
Exactly. It's the gold standard.
Right. It's the yardstick for measuring how severe someone's depression is. So a 3.6-point drop over a placebo might sound like a really small number. But in psychiatric terms, that is a highly significant leap.
It's massive.
It can literally be the difference between a patient being bedridden and unable to function versus being able to maintain a job and connect with their family. And because of data like this, COMP60 currently holds FDA breakthrough therapy status.
And beyond that, we also have incredibly precise imaging data for psilocybin.
Yeah.
There's a 2024 fMRI study by Siegel and colleagues that mapped exactly what psilocybin does to the human brain in real time.
Oh, the desynchronization study.
Yes. They watched it massively desynchronize human brain networks. It physically decouples the hippocampus, which is the center for memory and context, from the default mode network.
Wow.
This effectively stops a depressed brain from viewing every single new memory through that rigid negative lens of the ego.
That is incredible.
It is. We literally have high-definition temporal maps of psilocybin's therapeutic mechanism.
Okay, so that's psilocybin. And what do we have for mescaline?
We have zero modern therapeutic randomized controlled trials. Zero.
None.
None. No one is putting mescaline through a modern FDA-approved phase three framework to cure anxiety or depression. And furthermore, it has absolutely no modern human neuroimaging.
So no fMRI math.
Those beautiful fMRI maps showing the hippocampus decoupling, they simply do not exist for mescaline.
So what does this evidence base actually look like?
The entire modern evidence base for mescaline relies on controlled pharmacology studies in healthy volunteers, like the Basel study we talked about, alongside rich anthropological traditions and self-reported naturalistic surveys.
So what does this all mean? Because if you're listening to this and you're looking at the therapeutic potential of these substances to perhaps help with a mental health condition, it really sounds like for all the romanticism of the ancient desert cactus, if you need rigorous modern medical data, there isn't even a contest here.
No, honesty requires calling it exactly as it is. Psilocybin has a heavily funded, highly defined regulatory pathway. Mescaline has raw pharmacology and millennia of tradition. They might open the exact same 5-HT2A safe in the brain, but only one of them is being engineered into the future of modern psychiatry.
But I think we can't fully grasp their modern clinical and legal status without acknowledging where they actually originate from and how society is treating their natural sources today, because the history here is a stark contrast, too.
Oh, definitely. Mescaline was actually the very first psychedelic to ever be chemically isolated by Western
The
science.
very first.
Yeah, a chemist named Arthur Hefter pulled it from a peyote cactus way back in 1897.
1897.
Yeah, and this is the exact molecule that inspired Aldous Huxley to write The Doors of Perception in the 1950s.
Wow. And psilocybin arrived much later, right?
It did. Psilocybin was isolated by Sandoz chemist Albert Hofmann in 1958, and that was shortly after the banker, R. Gordon Wasson, published his famous 1957 account of partaking in a mushroom ceremony down in Mexico.
And today, those natural sources are facing drastically different ecological realities. Psilocybin comes from psilocybe mushrooms, which are incredibly easy to cultivate, right? Like in a plastic tub in a closet in just a few weeks.
Very easy, very fast.
Mescaline, however, is drawn chiefly from two cacti, the Andean San Pedro and peyote, which is found primarily in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. And peyote has been used for millennia. I mean, archaeologists have radiocarbon-dated peyote buttons found in a Texas cave to 5,700 years ago.
It's ancient. But the problem is peyote is incredibly slow growing. It takes years, sometimes a decade, just to mature in the harsh desert. And right now, it is officially classified as vulnerable.
Because of overharvesting?
Mostly, yeah. It faces severe overharvesting, mostly because poachers often rip the entire root out of the ground rather than just cutting the top to let it regrow, which effectively kills the entire organism.
That's heartbreaking.
It is. Combine that with massive habitat loss from agriculture and energy development, and the plant is just in a total crisis.
Which heavily impacts the legal and regulatory landscape we see today here in 2026. Because federally, in the US, both of these substances remain strictly Schedule I. So they are illegal under federal law.
Correct.
However, psilocybin has seen massive movement at the state level. It is actively regulated for therapeutic use in Oregon under Measure 109 and in Colorado under Proposition 122. But mescaline completely lacks those state clinical frameworks.
It does lack them. But mescaline has one incredibly unique carve-out that psilocybin doesn't.
Oh, the religious exemption.
Exactly. There's a federal religious exemption specifically for the Native American Church's sacramental use of peyote.
And state laws are very carefully navigating that tension. Like Colorado's natural medicine law actually allows for the communal use of mescaline, but it explicitly excludes peyote from that protection.
Right. They deliberately left peyote out.
To protect the plant from commercialization and poaching. Which makes me wonder, you know, is it possible that mescaline's total lack of commercial and clinical advancement is actually a good thing for peyote conservation?
That's a fascinating point.
I mean, does the fact that it takes 11 hours and makes you severely nauseous keep the pharmaceutical industry and the whole wellness tourism industry away from a highly vulnerable plant?
This raises an important question about the deep tension between ecological sustainability and medical access. And many conservationists argue exactly that point. Yes, they heavily favor the development of synthetic mescaline in a lab, or the use of the faster-growing, easily cultivated San Pedro cactus, specifically to relieve the pressure on wild peyote populations. The sheer logistical nightmare of clinical mescaline might actually, accidentally, be the best shield wild peyote currently has against the wellness industry.
Wow. So bringing all of this together for you listening, we are looking at two incredibly different molecular structures. You have a phenethylamine, built like dopamine, and you have a tryptamine prodrug that acts as a biological package.
Entirely different keys.
Different keys that turn the tumblers of the exact same neural doorway, the 5-HT2A receptor. It's not about crowning a winner between the two.
No, not at all. It's about fit.
Right, fit. Mescaline offers a long, physically demanding, embodied connection to one of the most ancient, continuous traditions on the planet. While psilocybin offers a shorter, highly efficient, intensely studied clinical reality that fits just neatly right into a modern therapeutic protocol.
And that shared receptor mechanism leaves us with a final, really provocative thought to mull over.
Let's hear it.
If the psychedelic state is fundamentally dictated by the lock, that 5-HT2A doorway, rather than the chemical scaffold of the key, what happens when artificial intelligence and computational chemistry begin designing entirely new, non-natural molecules from scratch?
Oh, what?
Could we soon engineer a perfect 5-HT2A key, one that provides the exact subjective depth and neural entropy of mescaline or psilocybin, but with zero nausea, zero cardiovascular load, and an onset and offset tailored perfectly to a standard 60-minute therapy hour?
That is wild. It really makes you wonder. If a jagged metal key and a digital key card can both open the same safe in the human mind, well, what happens when we use AI to pick the lock? Until next time, keep questioning the code.